which is United States v. Berdoliak. Mr. Niewoehner?
May it please the Court. This appeal presents a case in which the defendant, Edward Berdoliak, agreed to pay a bribe to rig the sale of the Scholl property so that he could obtain a finder's fee. That criminal agreement unquestionably caused harm to the Rosalind Franklin University. Berdoliak effectively conveyed away an exclusive right to negotiate for the Scholl property to Smithfield. And in doing so, he caused harm and a pecuniary loss to the university.
Is it actually possible to compute that loss?
Your Honor, I think no, in this instance. You might be able to make a reasonable approximation of it, but the problem is that because they corrupted the sales process...
When I meant compute, I would certainly accept a reasonable approximation. Is it possible even to make an approximation? Because Smithfield, is that what it was? It might have been the high bidder. So,
Your Honor, our view is no. The reasonable position in this, for purposes of the guidelines, the loss should have been determined by the use of the gain, because it would be so difficult to try to assess the value that was of the right that was taken from the university. In this instance, the district court should have turned to the gain as is an appropriate and alternative measurement under the guidelines.
Of course, can't gain be an independent basis for sentencing?
An independent basis under the guidelines, Your Honor?
I mean, you can have a situation in which You can have situations where there's gain but no loss, can't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we do want to punish those people, don't we?
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why the guidelines specifically point to give an alternative. And it's often done where the gain might essentially equate to the loss, but in instances where it doesn't, where you can't determine the loss, then absolutely, I think the best, under the guidelines, the approach has always been you take the intended loss or the loss, if you can determine it, and if you can't, you go to the gain. Here, the gain is relatively clear.
Is that the $1.5 million? $1.5 million?
Yes, you're right. The finder's fee was going to be $1.5 million, and that, in this instance, really should have been the marker for what the intended loss figure should have been.
You mean in addition to the $15 million? The $1.5 million on top of the $15 million?
Well, I think the loss figure should have been $1.5 million. That $1.5 million was potentially in addition to a $15 million sales price, but I don't think the loss to the university would have been $16.5 million. It would have only been the additional fraction of what they didn't get from the sale.
Well, at least the theory is, I assume that because there was that additional $1.5 million available to somebody in connection with the sale, it must have been worth $16.5 to somebody.
That's right, Your Honor. I think at least 16.5 is really the way we should look at this, because there is the evidence that the property was, in fact, worth significantly more, even into the low 20 millions, according to a market study done by the university.
You're saying this conspiracy took it off the market.
That's exactly right. That taking it out of the market, not allowing the market to function, to allow the university to get to figure out what the market value really was, that wasn't the intent of the conspirators when they decided to steer the sale. And that's effectively what they did. So as a result, the university never got the opportunity to really find out. We think 16.5 is probably not the correct market price, because the evidence shows it should have gone higher. But given the state of the record and given the fact that of how far the conspiracy got, it gets a little speculative to decide how much above 16.5 it should be. And therefore, using the gain really becomes an appropriate, whether you view it as a loss or whether you view it as a gain, as we're urging you to. $1.5 million was clearly the appropriate number to use under the guidelines.
That was the term that you had, that was part of the plea agreement, correct?
That's right.
Range of $1 to $2.5 million.
That's right. The parties agreed that was the correct figure. The probation office agreed that was the correct figure. That was really was not in dispute up until the point of the sentencing. And I think that the district court's error in that regard stems from sort of a fundamental misconception of what the damage done was in this instance. The district court approached this as if the only way that the university could lose any money was if one of the three offers that was presented at this June 5th, 2003 board meeting where they made the decision was better than the one that the university actually accepted. But that basic premise doesn't account for the loss that the university suffered even before that board meeting took place. It doesn't account for the fact that there were potentially many other interested parties that would have bid more if they had been given the opportunity.
Mr. New Owner, one of my concerns in this case is that the district judge made it pretty clear that regardless of how this loss might be correctly calculated under the guidelines, he was giving a sentence that he thought was appropriate under 3553A. What would be the point, even if we agree with you on the loss issue, of a remand?
I think there's two points to your question, Your Honor. One a legal matter, one a practical matter. I'm going to start with the practical matter. The district court clearly misconceived, again, the fundamental misconception about what the nature of the harm done. And that's demonstrated by the fact that even under the alternative reasoning that this district court pointed to, the highest figure the district court would even consider was $500,000 of loss. That's a significant difference between the 1.5.
Surely you want another judge to sentence, don't you?
Well, Your Honor, we have not.
You're not going to get anywhere with Judge Shader.
Your Honor, we have not sought a Rule 36. But
because he's made up his mind. And the business with the letters?
Your Honor, we very much agree that the...
It's ridiculous. I mean, you have a person like this, he could generate 1,000 letters.
You're preaching to the choir, Your Honor. We very much agree. We had a very fundamentally different conception of the nature of the culpability of Mr. Vrdoljak. And we tried to present to the judge all his prior ethical violations, the demonstration of his intent and culpability in this crime, which did not...
Did Judge Shader say anything about his history?
I think the most the district court acknowledged was that the government had presented sort of Mr. Hyde and Dr. Jekyll situation, but he found, as I think he said, the letters overwhelmed anything that the government presented, which the government does not, of course, agree with.
What do you make of the district judge's comments to the effect that he certainly had been aware of the defendant's reputation, that he had come from the perspective, even before the guidelines were adopted, of thinking that white-collar criminal sentences were usually too light, but that after he studied this case, he found himself surprised to decide that a non-custodial sentence would be appropriate? I've read this transcript. You and the district court went back and forth, and he went over this in great detail.
And, Your Honor, I think...
You don't have any new facts to present to the district judge, do you?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are additional facts we could point, but I think more fundamentally to your point, the district court came to the position it came to in part because of its misconception of the law. It misconceived under the law Mr. Vrdoljak's culpability and the damage done to the university. Our hope would be that Your Honors would instruct correctly what the real damage done here was, and also Mr. Vrdoljak's role in it. As a matter of law, the district court was just fundamentally off. And our thought would be that Your Honors would provide direction, and if looked through the proper prism, any judge who would look at this, our view would be coming to a different result other than the one the district court came to, notwithstanding the district court's long history, as he explained his views of white-collar crime and things like that. I think it really is a situation where going to a higher authority really is what's necessary here, and that's what we've done. So our thought is, when you look at the difference between, fundamentally the district court thought there was no loss, we would hope Your Honors would be instructing, no, there's $1.5 million of loss here.
Is this sentence unreasonable?
Your Honor, if we have not at this point, in our brief, we didn't challenge significant.
Why not? I mean, because what's the point of a remand if it's not an unreasonable sentence?
It's certainly procedurally unreasonable, and if Your Honors decided it's a $1.5 million loss, it is also substantively.
Did you recommend a sentence to the judge?
We did, Your Honor. We recommended the high end of the guideline range, which was 41 months of imprisonment.
Right, you did, of course, 41 months, yeah. So you do disagree with the sentence, yeah.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
As far as the Judge, I didn't find it immediately in the transcript, but where you just mentioned it, he found that there was no loss.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe $500,000, but really there's no loss. Now, is that a clearly erroneous finding?
It is, Your Honor. For the reasons we pointed out, and more extensively in our brief, because that determination that there's no loss simply doesn't recognize the deprivation. That conclusion really came only through the prism of looking at the three offers that were presented at the June 5th board meeting and the district court's determination that the Smithfield offer was the best of the three. That's fundamentally the wrong way to approach it. I think that's a de novo review in the sense that his legal approach was just fundamentally off. Approached correctly, looking at the damage from the beginning of the process through the corruption of the sales process, I think you find that, or you do find, in fact, that the loss clearly cannot be nothing. The right to exclusively negotiate is clearly worth something, and it became a valuation problem. And once you try to tackle that valuation problem, you realize that the gain is the best way to go here. $1.5 million is unquestionably the minimum amount the loss should have been. And that's what we'd urge Your Honors to find. So, Your Honors, we strongly urge Your Honors to come to the determination that we think here, that the message that should be sent to the district court is one that this is, in fact, there's significant damage done to the university that was not recognized by the district court. The proper approach recognizes that. And to the point of, you know, what is the point of asking Judge Shader to do something about this? Again, as a legal matter, I got to my practical points and I neglected my legal points. As a legal matter, it is Mr. Vrdoljak's burden to show that the district court would have done the exact same thing. Under Zahursky and Abbas and Anderson, consistently the case law is held that you need to have a clear expression from the district court that they would have done the exact same thing. That standard isn't met here. The district court explicitly refused to consider the proper guideline figure. And so both as a practical matter and as a legal matter, this case should be remanded.
Well, as a legal matter, what amount did he plead guilty to?
In his plea agreement, he agreed that the proper loss figure was between $1 million and $2.5 million, which effectively was the $1.5 gain figure. That's what the defense was arguing at sentence.
That he pleaded, that was in his plea agreement.
That is correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, I see I'm running into my
rebuttal. The plea agreement obviously is not binding on the district court on those issues.
You're right. It's binding only on the defendant. It was 11C1B agreement, so binding on the defendant, but certainly not on the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Niewoehner. Mr. Spivak?
Good morning, Your Honors. The judge made a reasonable approximation of what the loss was based on the evidence that was before the judge.
What would you do in a case like this? Suppose someone offers a bribe to a judge, and the judge says, great, you know, you really use the money, takes the bribe, rules in favor of the briber, and then afterwards says to the briber, you know, by the way, I really appreciated the bribe, I really needed the money, but I was going to vote for you anyway. Well, that'd be a no-loss case, right?
That would be a no-loss case.
And, in fact, you know, a sort of traditional defense for judges who take bribes is that, oh, well, I take a bribe from both sides in the case. That way it doesn't alter my judgment. So that would be another no-loss case. So would you think that in either of the cases I've given, you know, a very light sentence would be appropriate because there was no loss?
If there was no loss, the judge could also impose a sentence based on the fact that the loss understates the seriousness of the offense.
I'm sorry,
The loss understates the seriousness of the offense. The judge has other options in order to impose an appropriate sentence that go beyond
so
what the loss was.
Why is it so important whether there was a loss here? There's obviously, you know, it's corrupt behavior by a lawyer, you know, person of former government official and so on. Why isn't that a serious offense?
Well, the issue right now is it was a serious offense, and he pled guilty to this serious offense.
The punishment was not the punishment for a serious offense.
Well, it was the punishment that the judge felt appropriate based on what...
Yes, I know, but he seems to have thought it was appropriate because there wasn't, or he didn't think there was a loss. But...
No, it was...
Did he give too much weight to the fact that the loss is difficult to assess.
Not at all, Your Honor. I think the judge felt it was possible to assess what the loss was. The judge had before him, and the hard evidence that he had before him, where there were three offers for the property. Two of them were not corrupt at all. He had the $15 million offer from Smithfield. He had the $15.5 million offer from Loyola. He had what amounted to a $14.4 proposal from Farley.
You have Levine Radoliak. They're taking a lot of money for a corrupt purpose. Now, maybe the corrupt purpose it wasn't necessary because this was going to be the high bidder anyway, something like that, right? That's like the judge case. Why does that really mitigate the gravity of the crime seriously? It's the attempt to corrupt the bidding process. Isn't that the important thing rather than whether the school pays a little more for the service?
I'm sorry. I think that is a consideration, but there are other considerations too.
Like what? I don't get the letters. I must say, well, what's that about?
Judge, I think what Judge Shader was,
does that offset all the ethical violations that in your client's history?
It is something for the judge to consider. The judge acknowledged that there were negative things about the defendant, and there were also positive things that the judge felt went beyond the public perception, the perception that the public has of the defendant. In fact, Your Honor, as you're saying it to me.
These people aren't, they're not cross-examined about their letters, are they? And who are these people anyway?
Your Honor, they explained who they were, and in many of those letters.
But does anyone check on that? Does anyone check up on letters that are submitted?
The parties can check up on those things. I mean, these are traditional ways to do in a sentencing proceeding. And the people sign off on their letters.
Anyone can gin up a lot of letters, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Anyone who's prominent, has been in government and so on, can gin up a lot of letters.
That's possible, but, Your Honor, in the letters that were submitted for Mr. Radoliak, very often they contained anecdotal stories or actual things to give the judge an idea of the sorts of things that Mr. Radoliak did that might not be recognized or people don't realize.
You say the government can check up. How can they check up? Are they going to go to someone who writes a letter and quiz the person? That would be considered very intimidating behavior. I don't think there's any way they can verify these letters.
No, not unless there was going to be a hearing on, an actual hearing on it. It is definitely limited, but it is the way the sentencing process proceeds in court, just as the government very often proposes evidence that the defense does not have much of a chance to rebut or to go beyond. That is the sentencing process.
Like what? I don't think that's true. What does the government present in sentencing that a defendant can't check up on?
Just as the government is presenting 302s or evidence that they've collected, the defense has not had a chance to cross-examine government witnesses. It happens both ways.
Sometimes you'll have victims come in and test, in a sentencing hearing. They want to be heard and so on. And that's fine. They're there in open court. It's not letters. I can't think of a case where a judge relied on letters to give someone a heavier sentence.
Your Honor, I don't think it was.
Did they do that?
I apologize.
Did they ever do that?
Have I seen one where a judge relied on letters to impose a heavy sentence? I can't say I've seen one where that has happened, but I have seen the cases where the judge relies on 302s or government investigation reports in order to impose a sentence where those people are not cross-examined.
Victim impact statements usually aren't cross-examined either. Right?
They're usually not. Nor is the information that's put in the PSR is not normally cross-examined. The way the process works is we just don't seem to want to have a lengthy, drawn-out hearing, and as a result, everything is done on a more expedited and doesn't get into the usual cross-examination and things like that. But that is the way that our sentencings proceed. So I mean, the letters goes to something else. That goes to the reasonableness of the judge's sentence. What the government is appealing here, of course, is whether the judge committed clear error with respect to the finding of loss. You know, they're not arguing part.
I'm concerned also about a situation where the judge finds no loss, I think rather questionable reasoning, finds no loss that says, well, if I'm wrong and there's a loss, it doesn't make any difference.
Does that
reflect a thoughtful sentencing process, or just, you know, a determination to give a certain sentence regardless?
I think in this particular case, the judge gave his reasons for why he thought the sentence of probation was appropriate.
It's hypothetical to say I don't think there was any loss. If you don't think there's any loss, it's very hard to then go and say, but if there was a loss, you know, because you don't think there was a loss, so you don't want to give a
person. But in these circumstances, Your Honor, the two findings the judge had were very logical, because the judge felt, the reason he felt there was no loss was because he was discounting the Loyola bid or the Loyola offer. He said, if I'm not discounting the Loyola offer, then the loss is $500,000.
Why the loss should be material. I mean, how is this any different from any other bribery case? Like the judge hypothetical that I gave.
Your Honor, in this particular case, Mr. Vrdoljak was entitled to a finder's fee.
Try to steal a lot of money, try to defraud the school. Maybe you didn't succeed. Still seems like a very serious crime.
Judge, the crime is serious, and he pled guilty to it.
As a lawyer, should know better. It's not like some illiterate drug pusher.
That may be absolutely true, Your Honor, but what we're dealing with is whether the judge, what he was facing at the time of sentencing was, how do I evaluate the loss in this particular case? That's what he was evaluating. Once he evaluated the loss, the judge was free to do what he wanted to do.
Like this, really, really depreciates the significance of the crime.
I don't think so. Not at all.
We had a case. We reversed a one-day time-served sentence on a person for possession of child pornography, and we said you can't really assess the harm of such a thing. You know, photographs. But we, you know,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Makes the crime just seem trivial.
Your Honor, but that's putting the cart before the horse with respect to his assessment of loss. And the judge, you know, keep in mind also when we talk about what this so-called this scheme was about was to try to find a developer who would be able to develop the project and develop the property and be able to deal with zoning problems. It had to do with trying to someone who would be able to pay money to Mr. Levine. But the third part was to sell the property at fair market value. That was, in fact, what the scheme was. That's what the government told the probation officer.
It's sort of benign bribery, right? So in many corrupt countries and cities and so on, you can't get anything done without bribing. So you could argue, you know, the bribe really makes things better off.
I don't think it was benign bribery, Your Honor. I think that he intended to get fair market value for the property. That's what he thought he was going to get. What was going to happen here was that.
What significance does a sentence like probation have? It's nothing.
Oh, I disagree, Your Honor. I think somebody being on probation, particularly someone a lawyer,
an elderly person on probation.
I think the Supreme Court has even indicated that probation is a serious sentence.
Why?
Because a person is a convicted felon. And I can say from my point of view, I would not like that visited on me. I think that
you'd like it a lot better than being sent to jail for a week.
And or being executed or any of the other horrible things that could happen. But in fact, it is a serious label to put on a person to say that the person is a convicted felon. I don't think it could be taken lightly either.
Is this the crime for which he lost his law license?
If I recall, I think he voluntarily surrendered his license, but I'm not sure, Your Honor.
In this, because of this or something else?
I don't know the answer.
Because that was raised. You know, I'm 71 years old and I lost my law license, and everybody should feel sorry for me.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been because of this, Your Honor, that he would lose. But obviously he's not going to be able to practice because of this, you know, having the felony conviction. He would not be able to practice. So if he lost it for this or was going to lose it for this, he was not going to be able to practice law based on this conviction.
But that was one of the claims of he's already suffered a lot.
Exactly.
He's old.
Yeah. He's 71 years old, and now he's going to lose his ability to practice law. So that was a significant punishment.
If you get old enough, you can commit a white-collar crime, because nothing's going to happen to you.
Oh, I Judge.
You lose a license you don't need, and you're not going to be sent to prison, and you're old anyway, so what difference does it make? Sell a little bit of marijuana, you know, you go to prison. You can't say, well, you know, you don't have to send me to prison, I'm going to lose my law license or something. I don't have anything to lose.
No,
so you end up with a systematic differences in punishment between people who commit crimes, say, and people who commit fraud.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think that every case has to be looked at individually. You know, the fact that in this particular case he was 71 years old, that in this particular case the intent wasn't to cause the CMS to have any loss, that in this particular case the scheme didn't originate with him, that these are all the factors that go into it. And when you're talking about the young drug defendant, other factors.
The scheme originates with?
Your Honor, these are all factors that a judge can consider now in determining what an appropriate sentence is. It's not any one particular factor. You're focusing on a particular factor when, in fact, it's all the factors that go into the mix, even the letters that the court is not impressed with, but, in fact, those are other factors that go into it. And they tell stories about the defendant, and they give a fuller picture of the defendant and not the picture of the defendant that maybe people know from reading the newspaper or from hearing people talk about the particular defendant.
It's a matter of rumors. These ethical violations he's committed have been have led to, you know, sanctions imposed by government agencies. It's not just rumors, and right?
And the judge considered those things. The judge considered that there were allegations against him. The judge didn't think they were as serious as maybe Your Honor sees them, but the judge recognized that there were many negative things with respect to the defendant, but on the other hand, there were many positive aspects with respect to the defendant, and the judge was sentencing the whole person. And he was the one who had to make that decision, and the judge felt that there was a great number of things about the defendant that made him an appropriate sentence in this particular case. And one of those things was the fact that may I finish my thought, Your Honor? And one of those things was the fact that there was really very little either none or very little loss in this case.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Spivak. Mr. Niewoehner?
Your Honors, I have...
What is your strongest evidence that there was a loss of some sort to the school?
The strongest evidence is the undisputed evidence that Levine steered away any other potential buyer. That deprived the school of the ability to get full information of who the market was, and at the same time, it illustrates that they gave away an exclusive right to negotiate, which they had no right to do. Those two things cause a pecuniary harm, and I don't think the defendant has never even challenged that in its briefing. From there, you can compound that by the additional evidence that there are other entities that would have paid more than the $15 million sales price. Loyola and the Farley Group as being the best examples that they could have gone significantly above that. But if, Your Honor, to your point,
that's what they said after the fact.
Well, and they said at the time, really. I mean, the Farley Group, a week after June 5th, puts in an offer that's higher. So it's not just an after-the-fact rationalization. It's demonstrated by their actions at the time. And really undisputed that they would have gone higher. That the judge, as we pointed out, never suggested that the people who came from those entities weren't truthful or sincere when they said they would have gone higher. He just felt it irrelevant.
Did the Farley Group, is that the one that sent out the letter to the board?
That's right. The Farley group was the one who sort of breached the wall.
And that was what sort of alerted the fact that they were interested in paying more or something? I don't remember the exact fact of that.
That's exactly it. The Farley group in the fall of 2002 had submitted a $10 million offer, which was ignored, a $15 million offer, which was ignored. And finally, in May of 2003, they took the sort of unusual and extraordinary step of writing a letter to every single university board member to try to get somebody to answer their call. And that's the only thing that meant that the price that would have been at $9.5 million.
That bypassed Levine.
Right, exactly. At that point, he couldn't control it. The board knew that they were $5.5 million under the market.
What is Levine's status?
Your Honor, he has pled guilty. His sentencing has been postponed pending his cooperation in additional cases, this one and others. Your Honor, the two points I will make very shortly are, one, counsel suggested that the judge did consider negative things, but as a legal matter, he never considered $1.5 million in damage, and that is a signal failure. And the second point, complete it, counsel suggested that the defendant never intended anything but that the university get fair market value. That argument is sort of that the defendant is a perverse Robin Hood who defrauds charities yet doesn't intend that his victims suffer any harm. It just makes no sense. The intent of the defendant was to get his finder's fee, and he would do what it took to make that happen.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Niewallner and Mr. Spivak.